Save It for the Blind is sponsored by Kershaw Knives. Kershaw manufactures next-level pocket knives for outdoor enthusiasts. Save for the Blind is now also being sponsored by Roseville Motorsports. Roseville Motorsports is the greater Sacramento area's premier destination for all your power sports vehicle needs. Stop in today to browse off-road vehicles from leading manufacturers like Polaris, Yamaha, and more. If you guys are enjoying the show, we'd love to hear from you and get your support. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a 5-star rating. Your reviews really help us grow and reach more people. Thank you for being a part of our community.
Paul, you have the means and you've been very philanthropic throughout your life. What's your opinion on people that may have the means, are duck hunters, and are not involved with anything? Like either no conservation group, not giving back the resource essentially. And not that there's a lot of people like that, but I've met some people over the years where they could really make a difference.
There are a lot of people like that, unfortunately. And it's unfortunate. I don't understand it. I don't know. Maybe it was my upbringing. It's regardless of whether or not I was financially successful, I'd be doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't have Bird Haven Ranch. I'd have either an old dead motorhome or a trailer and a rice lease out there someplace, or I'd have my trailer or I'd have an old, you know, I probably would be of the means that I could have something, a membership at a Poco Loco type club or something like that. And so I don't understand it. I mean, I'm well off, but there's billionaires out there that I'm involved in whatever philanthropic thing I do. I'm either on the board or I'm watching that. I don't just provide funding, financial support to an organization or a cause unless I'm watching. So I'm either on an advisory board, a trust board, and really following money. And again, I'm totally out of the technology. And I went through one startup. I started my career in, I graduated from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo with an electrical engineering degree in 1975. And I went to, out of luck, I ended up going to a small company at the time. It was called Intel as a development engineer. And I was in development all my life, Intel and then Sun Microsystems and then Brocade Communications, Brocade Network. And again, the folks I know, they're still very involved with whatever kind of technology or business they were in, and they don't get involved. You know, a lot of them are at arm's length, providing funding. But I'm following, you know, passion, and I'd like to see more. I don't know why those people don't.
Yeah. Well, I think what's neat in your circumstance is like you've opened the door to your Disneyland, right? Like, and you've had countless people shoot their first deer or turkey or duck on your property. I mean, I've been involved with
a lot.
I don't know how many I can count, a lot over the years, but
that's the most rewarding part.
But that's what's special, right? Because that's a lot of people don't get to experience that. And when they meet you, they're like, wow. He was a really nice guy. I was like, he's just a normal person like everyone else.
You look at a kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, we're a planned land management, so we have eight deer tags a year. We've got a lot of deer on Bird Haven, and being right next door to Little Dry Creek and Howard Slough, and being on the Butte Creek corridor, we've got all sorts of animals. And you got to share it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, and again, there's nothing more rewarding than seeing the smile on a kid's face. They get their first deer.
Absolutely.
Or their first duck. I mean, or you see a young lady that's never held a weapon in their life, and they sit there on our sporting clays course and taking a going away shot, and they shoot and shoot and shoot, and they don't hit anything. They're about ready to cry. They're going to give up, and then they hit a clay target.
Yeah, changes.
Oh man, yeah. You see those smiles. You can't put a dollar figure on that.
Yeah,
and I just love it every year. I've never missed college camp, but I think I've missed a kid camp before. And being able to go out and see people experience something they've never experienced before.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is taking our friends out. My wife has friends that couldn't understand how my wife could support hunting. You know, uh-huh. It's so evil killing those birds and stuff. And they will take them up, and you might get lucky and have a day where there's 500,000 birds on Bird Haven, and you take them around and show them that, and you say, okay, yeah, we took less than 2,000 birds off this property this year. Look at, you know, this is just one day.
Yeah.
You know, and on a good day, we'll have, you know, over 300,000 birds on the property. And that's the other thing that's so rewarding. When we first started Bird Haven, if there was 30,000 birds on the property, wonderful.
Yeah.
And now, you know, there's just hundreds of thousands. Yeah. Birds eating, and you know, again, that's the habitat.
Yeah. So,
I wish, you know, and maybe they just haven't gotten to that point in their life, the philanthropists that are providing things, or, you know, again, I know a lot of them that have other
doing something else.
Yes, and they're very good at it. I mean, again, through Ducks Unlimited mainly, I've really met, you know, a lot of people that I would have never met before, and that's something very rewarding from my Ducks Unlimited career.
Can you speak to that and the commitment you made as being the president and what that entailed? And
it entails a lot, and I got to tell you, that is the most presidency at Ducks Unlimited is probably the thing that I'm most proud of. And it is a huge commitment. To become president, you have to come up through the ranks of Ducks Unlimited. Again, I started in the WAP board. The WAP board is really, you know, where I met other financially well-off folks, CEOs of major corporations. Gosh, you know, I have the privilege of hunting with Vice President Cheney on one side of me and Justice Scalia on the other side of me.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, I would have never had that opportunity without Ducks Unlimited. But you have to work your way up. So I got hornswoggled into it, actually.
Isn't that how it always happens?
Yeah. I don't remember what year it was, but, oh, yes, it was probably 2004 or 2003. There was, you know, in Ducks Unlimited, there's the event side, and then there's the conservation side. And in the events, there are regional vice presidents that report to flyway vice presidents. And we had a situation where between cycles, the Flyway vice president and the regional vice president decided to resign. And Dan Thiel, who is secretary for Ducks Unlimited and the COO of the WAP board, he was in development at the time, I believe. He calls me up and says, "Hey, we need some leadership out in California, and would you mind stepping in until a convention and being a regional vice president and helping out the events side of California?" "Oh, sure, you know, because we're gonna vote in a new vice president in June, and I think this was like March or something like that." And they didn't tell me they were going to vote me in.
trial run.
So unfortunately, you know, from Ducks Unlimited standpoint, back in the Eberhardt days, Bob Eberhardt was a president of Ducks Unlimited back in the 80s, and he was the CEO and owner, their family, the Eberhardt family, owned the Bank of Stockton. And back in the 80s, California was the leader for Ducks Unlimited from a fundraising standpoint. And I don't think it's ever been matched. California brought in $8 million.
In the 80s?
In the 80s.
Wow.
Dang.
That's big money now.
Oh, gosh, yeah. No, we've never matched it. I mean, we've gotten it back up to $3 or $4 million, but the Eberhardts did a wonderful job of that. So anyway, at that time, I think California was down to the 300,000, 400,000 in event money. It was very, very poor. And so so for 2 years, I was the regional vice president. So that covered California, Nevada, and Arizona, I believe. And then after that, I was voted in as the Flyway vice president for 2 years. And again, most of the presidents of Ducks Unlimited have come up through the events side of the house. And from there, I became an advisory vice president. I became the senior advisory vice president of conservation, which I got to tell you is the best job in Ducks Unlimited. And in Ducks Unlimited, there's two sides. There's the volunteer side and the staff side. And the staff reports to the CEO, and the volunteer side reports to the president. And for every chief position in Ducks Unlimited, there's an equivalent senior advisory vice president. So then I became senior advisory vice president of conservation. And like I said, that's the best job in Ducks Unlimited. And I held that through two presidents and had a wonderful time. DU is a huge organization, more than 700,000 members, 31,000 volunteers, and we're close to being a half a million in revenue at this point in time. And I lost my train of thought there. Did that for 2 years, and then you're first vice president for 2 years. As first vice president, you're at the beck and call of the president, doing whatever he or she wants you to do.
This is all volunteer, your all own volunteer. Money, your own travel, oh, all God. That stuff.
And, you know, people think that you get reimbursed for stuff. You do not. it's the most expensive job you can have. So then after first vice president, you become president for 2 years. Everything's on a two-year basis.
Okay.
Except we ended up, you know, first vice president, becomes chairman of the board. And we, for personal reasons, one of the guy that was next in line when I was chairman had to drop out. And the next in line behind that person couldn't take over at that time. So I was chairman of the board for from 2017 to 2020. So I had 3 years. And I can tell you, when I was president, that's a full-time job, and it's a tough job. It's not, you know, again, Ducks Unlimited, like any organization, has morphed over the years, and the volunteer positions really. Anything controversial takes place at the committee level, so that when you go to a board meeting, everything's pretty well resolved, and the senior vice presidents will report. You vote on things that have been very well vetted, whether it's conservation, events, marketing, all the other. Chiefs, everything is very well vetted before it ever comes up in front of the board. And so it's a huge commitment. You've got these committee meetings to go to. And that's what makes both CWA and Ducks Unlimited so powerful, is it's the volunteers. Mm-hmm. It's the people that are there. We have, Ducks Unlimited has huge influence when it comes to, you know, for DU's case, things like the farm bill, where we get a lot of money, you know, that's where the conservation money comes from. And CWA with the California legislature, you know, Henley and company have a lot of pull in Sacramento, and that's where the money is.
Mm-hmm.
I went through that whole thing, and then once I was president, and even as first vice president, my kudos go out to anybody that's been president of the organization, because it is a huge commitment. When I was president, my wife tells me, I probably did somewhere between 80 and 90,000 miles
Jeez.
A year of travel. And I look at I was fortunate enough, I had my own plane, so it wasn't too bad, but it was very expensive.
Yeah.
And no, we did not get reimbursed for any of that, although I did get taxed. I look at the presidents now, I look at Bob Squirrel, and they're doing this all on commercial travel. And I put in 80 to 90,000 miles a year going to conventions, state conventions, going to the big galas, going to board meetings, going to committee meetings, a lot of work on major donors. You know, again, that's another thing that Bird Haven did for a long time, was hosting and trying to develop major donors. Did that for both CWA and Ducks.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very hard job. And again, it's working with an NGO is very different than a private business. You know, what I've found through I've been fortunate enough that I've worked in private industry. I spent some time working with the government when I was at Sun Microsystems. I was one of the founding members of what was the federal division. So I spent 2 years working with the government. That's a different kind of business. So NGOs are one type of business, government's another type of business, and then universities are yet another type. They all work differently, and then private industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge challenge, and it's a, you know, motivating volunteers is much different than motivating somebody that works for you.
Yeah.
That was a learning process. But again, I think DU did it right, because you don't become president of that organization unless you've come up through the process and learned what it's like to work with an NGO. How do you motivate volunteers, employees?
Mm-hmm.
Very different.
Yeah.
Very, very
different. Paul, can you speak to what Brocade is and how that started?
Sure.
And that whole process of being an entrepreneur?
Sure. So again, I'm an electrical engineer by trade, and I've always been in development. I started, I actually started at a small company that went bankrupt. I had said, at Cal Poly, you have to do a senior project, and I had sold my senior project, which was a traffic queuing meter. For determining if you change a stop sign into a stoplight. That company went belly up.
So you sold it to a company and then went to work for them?
Yes.
Okay.
I was hired by them to modify it and commercialize it from a prototype to a real device. And I had done that for Caltrans. An old family friend, I was born in San Luis Obispo.
Yeah.
And a family friend was the regional traffic engineer for Caltrans. And so that's what I did my senior project on. And he said, well, I can pay for the product, or you can go to this company and sell it to them. And so I chose that, and they gave me a job, and they were basically a distributor for traffic signals out of Santa Clara, and there was a downturn at that time. It was 75, and just turned into 76, and a guy that worked there, we both got laid off, and he kind of took me under his wing, and I blanketed the Silicon Valley with my resume, and got lucky enough, because this was a, I don't know if they called it a recession. Yeah, it was a recession at the time, at least in that, in the electronics world. And I ended up getting a job with Intel, because Intel had a college program, and Andy Grove and Moore, those guys were sharp guys. Even though they were having a downturn, they would always hire college grads, keep the young kids coming into the organization. And so I had a very smart director at the memory systems division that hired me under the college program. He said, when did you graduate? I said, well, I walked in June, but I didn't graduate until my senior project was done in September. He says, great, you're within 6 months. I can hire you as a college grad. So I started at Intel, and at that time, a megabyte of mass storage for an IBM 370 computer from IBM was $500,000 from solid state memory. They actually still had magnetic memory back then. Donuts, little magnet donuts. So we sold it for for $250,000. So it was a good business. But anyway, I went from Intel to another small company, and that one made some drastic mistakes. I was there for a couple, 3 years, developing a Unix tower. That was all the rage at the time. And then I, after the third or fourth layoff, where I was doing the laying off, I laid myself off and went to Sun Microsystems. And at Sun, I had a great career. I was 2 years at the federal division, where we took Sun products and made them for specific government things. We did a lot of business with the alphabet soup. So I worked with CIA, NSA, a lot of NSA work, and Department of Defense things, where we would harden Sun products. Then I went over to the main part of, I couldn't handle working the government. It was different. And I transferred over to Sun Microsystems proper, and was responsible for all peripheral products except for printers. And so my expertise, just through the what I had been doing, was storage, main storage and mass storage. And I continued that, having peripheral products. I spent most of my time working on mass storage devices. And I also had all of the, I call them alphabet soup, UL, CSA, all of the regulatory bodies in my organization at Sun. But I spent most of my time on mass storage, and developed my development group, my development team, developed the very first fiber channel, commercially successful fiber channel product. So at that time, the fiber optic stuff was always an order of magnitude faster than Ethernet. So that became the cloud.
Okay.
So it was originally fiber channel. And I, in my Intel days, I had done a lot of work with the IBM channel. And that was, where two computers could share the same storage.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. So my career at Sun hit the glass ceiling. So we had another division, Sun Interactive, where my team had developed the very first video server. And we were ahead of our time, unfortunately. And I had done that, and I had applied to be the vice president of development of engineering for Sun Interactive. And I did not get that position. And I had just finished this project for them with my own resources and beg, borrow, and stealing from every department of Sun. And so I went, oh, okay, I'm not gonna go any further in this organization. And so I started looking for startups, because I had gone through Sun and I had gone through Intel, where I think at Intel, both at Intel and Sun, they were under $100 million in revenue when I started at them, and went way into the billions while I was, there. And so huge amount of growth. And I'll tell you, I look back on it, it was a rocket ship ride. And it was better than any PhD program you could get anywhere, especially at Intel and at Sun. And so I decided I wanted to get into a startup and see what it was like to go from actually like a prototype up. So I was putting my name out there to the venture capitalists, because a lot of times what happens in a startup is they have a brilliant engineering team that don't have a lot of management experience. And so after a year or two, when they get to that point, they're looking for a VP of engineering. I was looking for a job like that. But out of the blue, I get a call from a venture capitalist. And I was very disappointed at the time at Sun. I was commuting across the Dunbarton Bridge to what we at that time affectionately called Sun Quentin. East Palo Alto didn't like that name. And this was to the point where I just didn't have a boss that I really appreciated. And I was almost crying every day when I was going over that bridge. And I get this call from Cross Point Venture Partners from a gentleman named Seth Nyman, who was, he was an entrepreneur in training. He had had a couple of startups that failed, but Cross Point liked him. He's a brilliant guy. And he calls me up and says, "Hey, I hear you know Fiber Channel." Yeah. He says, "Well, we're interested in starting a company that would be based, you know, we would like to do a Fiber Channel project of some sort." He says, "Would you meet me for lunch?" I said, "Yeah, sure. Go to lunch." He says, "Can you put a team together?" I said, "Absolutely." He says, "Well, you want a job?" So I said, "Yeah, sure." So we started, we decided there were, Kumar Malavalli was at HP at the time. I was at Sun, and Seth, and another guy from HP, that was a marketing kind of guy, got together, and we spent a couple of months putting together a 13-page business plan on how to do storage area networks, which is a code word for the cloud. All the storage behind your computers is on a storage area network. I don't know what they're on now. It's probably, I think it's InfiniBand, but I don't know. At the time, it was Fiber Channel. So it turns out that in storage, and back, this was 1995, if you have, say your MasterCard, you have to have your systems built up to handle Black Friday. So you've got to have these huge storage devices, you know, mass storage on the back of a, at the time, mainframe computer. And then the rest of the year, they're only using 10% of it, 20%. So with a storage area network that was run on Fiber Channel at the time, you could share storage. So now you could have 10 computers using one EMC storage array, as opposed to having an EMC storage array on one. So by having this shared device, you end up with reliability, number one, because you can mirror everything, and that's where the huge value comes from, is this the software that goes along with the storage. So Brocade was very successful because it cut the operating expense of a company, gosh, in half, maybe their storage or less. And in addition to that, through the software that we provided, you could you take care of your capital expense rather, you know, for the storage, and then you could take care of your operating expense by cutting your staff in half because you had software that would control this stuff. One person could control an awful lot of you know, computers and storage versus what it used to take. That's why it was so successful. And we had some really brilliant people there. And I owe them a lot.
Exciting news. Our hunt program is now accepting applications for spring turkey and pig hunts. Visit cowwaterfowl.org to apply today. We're also offering free mentored turkey hunts at Sacramento National Wildlife Refuge and Delavan National Wildlife Refuge, an incredible opportunity for new hunters to gain hands-on experience in the field. Camp registration is now open. If you have a young hunter looking to obtain their hunter education certificate, we offer 4 2.5-day camps designed to provide hands-on learning and certification. These take place June through July. While you're there, don't miss our free membership deal. Purchase a membership and receive a free Realtree sweatshirt while supplies last. You can also apply for hunts, purchase tickets for upcoming events, and show your support for waterfowl conservation. Some of the upcoming events are Bishop and Dixon Banquet, March 15th, Stockton Banquet, March 20th, Brentwood East County Spring Fling, March 22nd, Placerville Banquet, March 22nd. Don't miss out. Visit cowwaterfowl.org now.
When you started, how small was the company? And when you finally got out, how big was it?
I was employee number one. there was an employee number zero. That was the kegerator. and actually, it was the spookiest time of my life. So here I am, I was a director level engineer at Sun Microsystems, making a very, very good, upper middle class kind of salary. You know, we had a motorhome, we had a nice house, kids in, going to college. Or getting ready to go to college, very comfortable living. And I cut my pay. I've got kids looking at college. I've got expenses, I've got a mortgage.
Yeah.
And I cut my salary or my total compensation package probably into a fifth. I can tell you, I was probably making $500,000 total, through stock options and stuff at the time, which was high in those days. And down to $100,000. And it was like Sandy and I got on top of El Capitan at Yosemite and jumped off the cliff, never experiencing parachuting or anything. And here we're doing free dive. hope the parachute opens, and boy, did it ever. It was a hell of a ride. So, I had put together a team of my top folks from Sun Microsystems, top software guy, top systems guy, great. And I knew if I had those guys, the technology would be successful. Mm-hmm. And we went from, in that first year, I think we got up to the first year and a half, probably 135 people. 125 of them were in engineering. Maybe 100, I don't know. When I left during my time at Brocade, I got to the point where engineering, I had taken engineering from nothing up to about 800 people. And for us to continue on, we really needed to have expertise at the Oracle level, at the big database level, and that wasn't me. And so I decided to replace myself as VP of engineering, and I became first time I've become an individual contributor since maybe 1976, 78, from management. That was nice. And I was working business development, trying to acquire companies. That was something new to me. I could never get myself into the upper level of software. I understood the software up to the operating system, certainly at the firmware area, but I could not do it. So we brought in a VP of engineering, and we brought in the wrong person. And we went through explosive growth at that time. I think worldwide, we had maybe 4,500 employees, and this is 2003, somewhere in there. And when I got out of engineering, it kind of went. It went the wrong way. And so we ended up having to let go the person that we hired to be VP of engineering. And I took it over again. And we went from 1,200 people in engineering back down to 800. And during that period of time, we didn't put out a single product, and got back into it. And I got a product out probably in a month and a half, it was for IBM, and it was successful. And I remember everybody was so happy. It was good time.
Yeah.
So it was storage area networks. There's still we had 80% of the marketplace. Cisco had the other 20%. We were actually partners with Cisco at the time, and then because they didn't think nobody thought Fibre Channel was going to make it, and it did for quite a while. It's been replaced since then, but we lost my train of thought again. Got back. We had 80% of the marketplace. Cisco had 20%. Cisco was going to buy us. We were a public company at the time, and actually that was something I couldn't understand. So, at its peak, things are different now. People make billions and billions of dollars, but Brocade, at its peak before the crash. We were worth capitalized. Brocade was worth $26.5 billion, and we were worth more than GM at the time. We're going, this is ridiculous. Yeah. The stock had gone to, over $140 a share after a number of splits and everything, and. Then it went from, when the crash hit, it went from $142 a share, which was ridiculous, down to, I think $4. Yeah. And, so I'm not a billionaire. there was a period of time, I think about 3 weeks, where on paper I was a billionaire, but
yeah,
I'm not. So I'm glad. It was a rocket ship ride. And then I retired in 2005, and really that's when I spent all of my time with Ducks Unlimited, Cal Poly and UC Davis.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit with CWA too.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Not as much as those other entities. It was a wonderful time.
Yeah. Paul, you kind of alluded to you put your poker chips all in when you took a huge pay cut for aspiring entrepreneurs. What's the one advice you'd give to somebody that's still trying to make it and getting there.
I give the same advice to everybody. Follow your passion. The rest will come.
Yeah.
I don't care what industry or, you know, whether it's being a wildlife management person. The only thing that matters is follow your passion, because then when you work, you're not working, you're enjoying yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's important. It's happiness.
Yep.
I'll tell you, financial success is nothing but complication. I'm serious.
I can see that happens.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. Now, you could obviously hunt anywhere you want, right? If you wanted to, in terms of you can go to Arkansas, you can go to Missouri, wherever in terms of waterfowl hunting. Why is the Upper Butte Basin so important to you in that location?
Well, that's where I grew up, you know. And again, you look at these other places, the biggest flyway is the Pacific Flyway. Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is the wintering ground. You can find the equivalent in the Mississippi Valley, you know, the Alluvial Valley in Arkansas and Louisiana. It's all different.
Mm-hmm.
It's here because this is where, you know, my roots are.
Mm-hmm.
The places I do, you know, through my Ducks Unlimited experience, I've hunted everywhere. I enjoy, you know, I have a hard time understanding some of these folks that have duck clubs and they have their blind and they go to the same blind every day or once a week. That's not me. Yeah. You know, I don't want to go to the same blind twice in a season at Birdhaven.
Uh-huh.
And I've been lucky enough to be able to hunt all over North America, Canada, Mexico, and the United States. And what I enjoy, it's all different. You know, hunting timber is so much different than hunting, you know, timber in Arkansas.
Yeah.
The guy that my predecessor, George Dunklin, owns five oaks. I've gotten to hunt there. I've hunted eiders out on the tip of Maine, out with the tide coming in and a boat that the motor didn't work. And I'm going, oh God, this is bad. I've hunted in coffin blinds up in Alberta. I've been to Manitoba up in the Delta, been out in the prairie potholes and all over, you know, whether it's in the Dakotas or elsewhere. And it's all different. And that's what's neat about it is it, you know, something that you'll never see down here is a flock of ducks leapfrogging each other through a soybean field in Canada. It's amazing. Hunting up there in September, the birds are dumb. You could be out there in pheasant, you know, in blaze orange, and they're going to just come down right on top of you, you know? So, versus hunting wood ducks in the woody hole or in the corn, you know. Yeah. Again, something that we have at Birdhaven is hunting the corn if it's cold, and having those birds come down hunting with a 410.
Mm-hmm.
And shooting mallards or wood ducks or specks with, you know, I normally shoot a 28 gauge, but towards the end of the season, I'll go out. I didn't this year because the birds just weren't around. And do one hunt, at least one hunt a year with a 410.
Yeah.
And again, we're blessed at Birdhaven in that you can do that.
Yeah.
You know, you can shoot a duck at 10 or 15 yards and have them have them decoy into you. It's wonderful.
Yeah, talking about shotguns, I know you've started collecting Parker shotguns. Or has this been an ongoing thing? Because when I came to Birdhaven, you had just gotten back from either getting some or looking at some. What's your fascination with Parker shotguns?
It wasn't. That happened this year. So
that's a new passion.
Yes. And that happened. Actually, my first Parker shotgun was I picked it up in. It's actually a Parker reproduction, a 20-gauge side-by-side. And we were at the Alaska State Convention. I think it was the very first convention I went to. And we were in Anchorage, and we were walking around. Sandy and I were walking around. Oh, there's a gun store. And there in the case was a Parker reproduction, a 20-gauge Winchester. Parker was purchased by Remington. And then ultimately given license, Remington gave license to Winchester to build their actually the same gun.
Okay.
And that sat in my closet forever. I shot it maybe half a box of shells out of it, and it sat forever. And then this year up at Highland Hills, I go to Highland Hills, which is a Upland Game Lodge, beautiful place, highly recommend. And I went up with a good friend of mine who's also my attorney, who is another shotgun collector, not a Parker collector, but his buddy that came with us is a huge Parker aficionado. And at the same time, this was in November of this last year, 2024, Ducks Unlimited in November always has what they call an online auction where they open up the vault, and that's the gun vault. And they had the very first item on the auction was a Parker 16 gauge Parker Packmeyer Invincible. So in Parker world, there were a beautiful gun.
What year is that gun made?
1928.
Oh, wow.
So Packmeyer, who is, you know, the Packmeyer recoil cushion.
Okay.
Packmeyer was down in Los Angeles. He was extremely good. He was a master gunsmith. And what he would do would take Parker, like a 28 Parker, 1928 Parker, and he would do gunsmithing stuff to it, probably do some trigger work, whatever. But then he would hire one of the master engravers and take those guns and turn them into what was called an invincible. So there's grades of Parkers from a V grade to an A1 grade, and then there's the invincible. There were three invincibles made, two 12-gauge and one 16-gauge. Those three guns are in the NRA museum, and they're probably worth $1 million or more, but they had beautiful engraving on them, and they're just wonderful guns. So Packmeyer would take these guns, and he made money off them and sell them, but he made a number of them and donated them to the particular gun I got. And the reason I bought it was on the pistol grip, there's an emblem that says, I forgot their first name. Packmeyer donated to Ducks Unlimited. And we're still trying to figure out how it got into the system. We, you know, again, back at that time, we think this happened in the 40s or early 50s.
Wow. So it's been with DU for a long time.
Oh, no. It was Pacmeier made that gun, you know, and turned it into a Pacmeier Invincible. So it's a copy of the 16 gauge Invincible. And it was donated probably to, or it came, Pacmeier had donated a bunch of stuff to Ducks Unlimited. We can't find out, we've not been able to trace it into Ducks Unlimited, but I think it probably was donated to a local chapter, because at that time, you got to remember, Los Angeles had a lot of hunting down there. John Wayne, Errol Flynn, all the big actors were waterfowlers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they were, you know, the number one, California was the number one area. So I think it went to a gala, and somehow it came up for auction again back maybe September 24, and Ducks Unlimited purchased it to put it in that auction.
Gotcha.
And so I ended up purchasing in that auction. And coincidentally, at the same time, I meet Bobby. He's the
Parker aficionado.
Yeah. He's got... He's got over 90 Parker.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And the other thing he introduced me to was he has a couple of old punk guns.
Oh, that's cool.
He brought, when he came up to Birdhaven, he brought a 4-gauge.
Oh, wow.
And I was foolish enough to shoot it.
You shouldered it?
I shouldered it. I'll show you the video. And... thank God he was behind me, because I would have ended up on my
wow.
On my butt.
Oh, my gosh.
But I didn't see it, but I shot the... I got it pulverizes the clay target that I shot at.
Yeah.
So we were shooting light loads. It was 3 ounces of number... I don't know if it was number sevens or number nines.
3 ounces.
Oh, my God. And a normal load was 6 ounces
of
nines when they were used, you know, for market hunting. And so anyway, that got me interested in Parkers. And so unfortunately, I said to Bobby, I said, you know, because all I shoot is really 28 gauge. I said, man, I wish I had a 28 gauge. So he found a 28 gauge that was a real Parker, not a Winchester Parker. And he said, yeah, I got you one. It's $38,000. I think I'll pass. And so a week or two later, he comes up with a reproduction that was reasonably... priced. Now that's what I'm shooting.
Okay.
So I'm kind of fallen for these, you know, from my upland game shooting. I've always had a problem where I can't my gun, and so if you're canted, believe it or not, in one direction, you're going to be behind the bird. In the other direction, you're going to be in front of the bird. And what I find, I don't know why it is. I think it's because of the sight picture you get with a side-by-side. It's so wide. I don't can't.
If it fixed your cans.
I have to think about it because my normal go-to gun is a... Krieghoff K20 that I shoot usually in 28 gauge. And I have to even though it's fitted to me and everything, I have to consciously think about not canting the gun. And so now I'm pretty much shooting side by side, at least for the time being.
Yeah.
So I have three Parkers now. I have 20 gauge reproduction, 28 gauge reproduction, and the 16 gauge. Now, not knowing, you know, the I knew I wanted the 16 gauge, but it turns out it's a wonderful goose gun. It'd be great for refuge shooting because the two barrels are full and extra full.
Oh, nice.
So if you shoot a bird at 20 yards, it's pretty tenderized by the time it comes down.
Now, what are you guys shooting? Are you guys hand loading or are you guys buying like Boss?
No. So that's another thing. I've let Boss know this, but I am a big Boss fan. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much all I shoot. So we have at Birdhaven, we don't let anybody shoot more than a 20 gauge. So it turns out that I have a couple of little 28 gauge, are they Mossbergs that will not cycle Boss shells.
Mm.
And, lo and behold, I have this 28 gauge Parker. The safety won't come off on the Parkers with the 28 with the Boss shells, and so I've told them about it. I don't know if you know. I think it's the
brass or
it's the brass. It's the it's the thickness of the rim on the brass that's preventing it from working in the Parker. Now I've been it's expensive as all get out, but I've been shooting the tungsten loads.
Mm-hmm.
Have you tried any of that? Oh my gosh. Shot
some of the TSS stuff. Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Oh, that will, I mean, it just actually loads. And so Boss, if you're listening, instead of just offering turkey loads in tungsten, you need to be coming out with a tungsten matrix or tungsten load. I hope they do that. But anyway, that's kind of the end of the season is what I use.
Yeah. Paul, I have one last question for you. Out of anywhere on the ranch, what's your favorite place to hunt? Or the most memorable one?
That's a great question.
Oh, gosh. Well, it changes, you know?
Yeah.
At one point in time, I would have said Blind 3 in the South Marsh.
Yeah, South Marsh is cool.
Years ago, and it's coming back now. And then it moved to Blind 5 in South Marsh. But those weren't necessarily, those were the most consistent. And Blind 5 is actually the center point of the South Marsh.
Okay.
So that's why it's the most consistent. Probably my favorite spots when they're hunting right is the Woody Hole. Mm-hmm. You've got ancient riparian on both sides of you. You've got the mallards, wood ducks coming in. It's beautiful. You'll be visited by bald eagles and this other stuff. Blind one in the 60.
Okay.
Because again, it's the I think it's because the 60 is the confluence of Howard Slough and Campbell Slough come together. And so it's 60 acres tall, and it's riparian on both sides. And it's just beautiful hunting in there. So those are and it, like I said, it changes because the marsh changes.
Yeah.
And Pop's Place is also. Right, you know, they're all.
Yeah,
they're, that's why I say I never go to the same place. Yeah. Twice.
And species wise, you guys just like to hunt.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm a, you know, I can't understand, you know, mallard bigots, because you know they're all different.
Yeah,
and they all taste good. You know.
Yeah.
Again, everybody that knows me knows that I've. For years, Dennis and I tried to get a full brace of Drake Spoonies.
Yeah,
it's impossible. It is. I swear to God, if you get five Drake Spoonies in the morning, you'll never find number six or number seven. It just doesn't happen.
Oh, that's
but you know, anything that's up in the up in the Sacramento Valley. Everything's feeding on rice.
That, exactly.
You know, so it's they all taste good.
Yeah, I've never been able to blindfold do the species test, and this is a mallard, this one's this. And I haven't seen anyone that can do it. So, species get a little bit of hate over others, but you know, not warranted, especially up in the Sacramento Valley.
Yeah, they're all
and
the same stuff.
You know, there are different challenges. I mean, it's beautiful having a sprig or a mallard coming into you with feet out. Mm-hmm. And actually, my favorite bird now is specks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speckle belly geese. They just
They work great.
Oh, they decoy in. You get a good caller with you. I'm terrible caller. So, you get a good caller bringing them in, and they just get their feet out. That's wonderful. But then hitting a wood duck when they're jinxing around, or a teal coming through 90 miles an hour. Yeah. They're all different. You know, it's and that's why I say I don't want to sit there and, you know, every couple of years or something, I'll want to try and get a brace of mallards, but I don't really care, you know.
Yeah.
I have, like, again, my greatest satisfaction comes from college camp and kids getting their first bird.
Yeah.
Seeing that much more. And again, we haven't really talked about the research that's going on at Bird Haven with the integrated wetland management for mosquito control. If you put that into YouTube, you'll find John Vion, our PhD candidate. You know, we're doing a up to 7 year research on this. We're finished year three. We're going into year four. Hopefully, John has passed his qualifications, so he is truly a PhD candidate now, and we're hoping in the next 2 years he gets his PhD. And what we're trying to do is eliminate mosquito control on the
please
land.
For the love of God, please.
It is, you know, it's sad, and it, you know, pesticides just are not the right way to do this. And through developing mosquito predators, we can do a better job. The indication in the research is that we can do a better job than pesticides, but it's not easy. You have to do a lot of dirt work. Make your, you know, again, I refer you to John's videos.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you how to do it. But what's happened is we here in California, we have a Mediterranean climate, and we've turned it 180 degrees out of phase.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you match a Mediterranean climate, have your water come up and down, you make lots of invertebrates that love to eat mosquito larvae. And so we generate beetles and dragonflies and that kind of stuff. And the preliminary indication is it does as good, if not a better job than pesticides. And it leaves a lot of food for the critters.
Everything. That's what's hard on a wetland manager side. I mean, you're trying to provide habitat and do all these things. And you're hit with the big bill.
When you put a larvicide out on it, it kills everything.
Yep.
And unfortunately, it takes, you know, up to 21 days to get a dragonfly, and it only takes 5 days to get a mosquito. So unless you have those predators already there,
right,
you're going to lose. So anyway, it's working, and we're having a lot of fun.
Good. We don't need the spraying or them flying over one day before opening day.
Yeah, we had that. We had an aerial spray.
Oh,
Yeah, at Butte Creek Island Ranch. It was
2 days before opening day.
3 days? It was Thursday. Opening day was a Saturday, and it was very well populated. It was pretty stuffed, and plane came over and just blew everything out.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there, and I was like watching it happen, and just a cloud of ducks get up and just go, and I was not happy at the
And it's, you know, it's very expensive. Yeah, I mean, it is. Again, that's another huge expense at Birdhaven. But we're doing the science. We've got 800 acres under, you know, this is unheard of, 400 acres of test and 400 acres of
Control?
Yeah, control.
Control.
800 acres of control, and we're working with Butte County Vector Control, cooperating with us. We're all learning a bunch.
Yeah, no,
we're about ready to publish the first draft.
Oh, good.
Of the findings, and that should come out in the next month or so. We're getting all the stakeholders. Comments right now before we put it out to the public.
Nice. We'll have to get John on here and talk about it.
That'd be good.
Yeah, no, I was going to ask you guys if you wanted John or Andy in here. I would suggest that you do that
for sure.
This would be a good podcast.
I think so.
And I would have Andy and John in here at the same time.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
Hopefully the best management practices will be able to change them. And again, you got to change your topology and stuff of your wetlands and how you manage them. So it'll take years and years and years to disseminate out into the refuges and stuff. But I'm hoping that's my goal, is to make this available to people.
Yeah.
So that we can do it naturally. We can take care of the mosquitoes naturally as opposed to with pesticides.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, Paul, we'll probably leave it with that. I want to say thank you so much for coming on, being a leader in conservation. I think your story is amazing. And I just want to touch about, you know, you just letting people onto your property, giving back to the hunting community. So as a hunter, I just want to say thank you for that. And thanks for joining us. I
appreciate it. Yeah, been fun.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
You bet.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.